Welcome to Charlotte Readers Podcast, where authors give voice to their written words. This is the show where we meet Charlotte area authors and those who visit the Queen City, and we hear them read their work. This is Season 2, sponsored by Park Road Books, the oldest and only independent bookstore in Charlotte. I don't know about you, but I get a good feeling when I'm surrounded by a world of new books, and an even better feeling when I know I'm supporting the local independent bookstore. Consider stopping by Park Road Books for your feel-good experience. You'll meet a friendly staff ready to recommend that next great read, just for you. Speaking of feeling good, I've got a good feeling that you will enjoy our guest author today. So let's get to it. I'm your host, Landis Wade. Thank you for listening. In this episode, we run headlong into a family story of cocaine, race, and ambition in the New South. They say truth is often stranger than fiction, and this true story of a drug dealer's life in Charlotte is no exception. The book is called Money Rock, and in it, author Pam Kelly pulls back the curtain to reveal a Charlotte history that is little known and not discussed enough. Pam's career as an award-winning journalist allowed her to cover the gunfight that led to Money Rock's decline, and then years later, his rebirth as a born-again preacher. You may be surprised at what you learn in this historical account that reads like a novel. We start first with a 1985 shootout in a Charlotte public housing project called Piedmont Courts.
Something was up in Piedmont Courts. Belton Lamont Platt was making an entrance, but not in his typical way. Usually, he steered his Cadillac to the curb of the main strip, where he'd greet familiar faces hanging around the public housing apartments, then slip inside the unit where he conducted business. This time, he'd chosen a back way. He and his three men approached on foot. They crossed a bridge over a trickling creek, then passed a neighborhood park with its broken merry-go-round and glass shards thick under the monkey bars. This time, he and his crew had gone to the trouble of dressing alike, in ball caps and plastic rain ponchos, which Belton had bought that morning at the Army-Navy surplus store. The caps obscured their identities. The dark green ponchos hid their guns. The date was Saturday, November 30th, 1985. After Thanksgiving, shoppers filled local malls, fragrant pines and firs, freshly cut from North Carolina's mountains, stocked Christmas tree lots. It was gray and rainy, a lazy holiday weekend in Charlotte, but not for Belton, who dominated Piedmont Court's cocaine trade and meant to keep it that way. He was 22 years old, with a sprinkling of brown freckles across his caramel-colored cheeks that would later be noted, freckles on face, in FBI descriptions. He ran on ego and ignorance, good intentions and greed, but he had a reputation in Piedmont Courts as a no-nonsense guy, out to make money, not trouble. He acknowledged older residents with yes ma'ams and yes sirs, and was careful to avoid profanity. Women went for him. His earnest nature put people at ease. When he smiled, his brown eyes lit up. Today, however, Belton wasn't smiling. The reputation of cocaine and coke dealers has been so bad in America for so long that it's easy to forget that stretch of time in the 1970s before Belton got into the game, when the drug was associated with rich white people, not black gangsters. In August 1977, when Belton was 13, the Charlotte News published a front-page feature whose casual treatment of cocaine now seems extraordinary. Labeled Cocaine, Drug of the Rich, the story opened with a man it called Paul, a 30-something manufacturer's representative who places his straw into a tiny mound of cocaine powder, lifts it to his nose, and inhales. Cocaine, he said with a smile, is probably the most sociable drug in the world. But the drug's reputation was evolving by the time Belton began dealing in 1983. Hardcore users were freebasing, smoking a mixture of coke and ether. The intense high had caught on in Charlotte's poor black neighborhoods and was hastening their decay. In Piedmont Courts, residents were accustomed to a certain level of lawlessness. Liquor houses, apartments where residents illegally sold alcohol, were as much a part of life as the white church volunteers who showed up to tutor Piedmont Courts children. Drugs were freely bought and sold. Men fought with fists or knives or sometimes guns. For years, however, a protocol had existed, an unwritten contract that said if you weren't involved, you had little to fear. But by the autumn of 1985, as Piedmont Court's tall oaks dropped their leaves onto bare dirt front yards, the community's fragile equilibrium was shifting. A 69-year-old woman had shown a newspaper reporter the axe, pick, machete, and .22-caliber pistol she kept for safety near her bed. The liberal white minister of Siegel Avenue Presbyterian Church, across the street from the project, had pleaded with police and city council members to do something. He even offered to raise money for undercover drug buys, but found no takers. Violent crime had begun ticking up nationally. The day before Belton walked into Piedmont Courts with his gun concealed under a poncho, the New York Times published its first front-page story about crack, an addictive, purified form of cocaine that had appeared in the Bronx and was spreading through the city. Crack hadn't hit Charlotte yet, at least not in large quantities. That would soon change.
Pam Kelly's book, Money Rock, grew out of her work at the Charlotte Observer, where she was a reporter for more than 30 years. Shelf Awareness described Money Rock as a hell of a story, like a New South version of The Wire. Money Rock, the man, was one of Charlotte's most successful cocaine dealers, and his story is interwoven with the historical racial disparities that continue to segregate in a city on the rise. Pam's favorite stories have always been about underdogs and outsiders, but as a reporter, she covered the gamut. Investigations to features. She's won honors from the National Press Club, National Education Writers Association, and the Society for Features Journalism. Pam grew up in Ohio in the same county as Hillbilly Elegy's J.D. Vance. She headed south for college at UNC Chapel Hill and never left. She has an MFA in creative nonfiction from Goucher College and lives in Cornelius with her husband, a professor at Davidson College. Pam, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This book you've written, Money Rock, on the front of the book it says, a family story of cocaine, race, and ambition in the New South, but this book is more than just about one man's story with drugs, isn't it?
It is, and you could say when it's about cocaine, race, and ambition, it's about this family story, but it's also about cocaine, race, and ambition in Charlotte, and in some ways about Charlotte's ambition.
Yeah, I was also thinking when I read this book, I kept thinking you're peeling back, and I'm a native Charlottean except for 1 year. I've been here, maybe I shouldn't say this, but 60 years. But it seems like you're peeling back one layer after another of this onion, you know, we call Charlotte, and the core is not very pretty.
Yeah, I started looking at Piedmont Courts in particular when I went back to write this book after covering this shootout trial many years earlier. And when I first covered the shootout trial, I kind of just took everything at face value. Yes, Piedmont Courts was where poor people lived and they all happened to be black. But when I came back to it in about 2012 and looked at it again, I started asking why. Why was Piedmont Court there? Why were all the people black? Why did it exist in this prosperous city? And once you pull that string, you eventually get back to slavery.
Which is not an easy thing to talk about. And you actually mentioned that, we may get to that at some point in the mm-hmm. show here, about how the Observer was writing a story or a series of stories, and they talked at length about whether or not they would actually go to that particular issue, and they mm-hmm. thought the readers would be turned off by the story if they did.
Yeah.
So this story, when I was thinking about it, these layers that you're peeling back, you sort of take a few jabs at the idea of a world-class city and uptown versus downtown, and you know, there's so much going on here other than just Belton Platt and what happened in this shootout. But that shootout also, by the way, is only about 200 yards from where we're sitting right now.
That's right.
We're in Advent co-working studio. A very up hip kind of, you know, they didn't have, you know, the devices we're even talking on today and recording abilities. But just a couple of blocks from here, you had a different environment, a different kind of Charlotte than what people like to talk about, right?
Yeah, right. And And that's the thing about Charlotte is, I mean, it's always been focused on the future and on progress, you know, which is fine. But because of that, and I think because Charlotte does have a habit of tearing down its old buildings, it's hard to know the history. I actually, when I was first working on this, I met Belton at these nice apartments, Siegel Point Apartments, which is what has replaced Piedmont Courts. And we walked around, and he tried to find the place where the shootout occurred. It was really difficult for him to find because the roads had changed, and he just walked around and said, "Wow," a lot, is what I remembered. He could hardly believe it.
Well, wow is also a word that describes what was going on this particular day in 1985. It was, as you describe it in the book, it was something natural for bad guys to shoot at one another, but not up until that point in time to have the collateral damage that occurred in this case.
Yeah.
And so that's really what led to the increased focus on the prosecution, right? I mean, you had innocent bystanders who were caught up in this gun battle.
Right. Seven people were injured that day, and five of them were bystanders, including a 14-year-old who was pregnant. That didn't happen in Charlotte, and it got front page attention on the Charlotte Observer for days. It was the top story on TV stations, and it really, I think, looking back, I think it kind of alerted the city that it had a problem more than it realized. And people I've talked to at the time, including Harvey Gantt, who was mayor then, said, you know, we were really focused. We were starting to make inroads with banking and growth, and that's what we were focused on. We were not focused on these problems that, you know, linked to the past.
Now, just to give the listeners a little bit of the story arc here, you start the book with this dramatic gun battle in Piedmont Courts, and then you take us through Belton Platt's life history. And it was an interesting ride because after the fight, he's convicted in state court. He goes to prison. The conviction is overturned. He comes back, and he gets in trouble again. This time he goes to federal court. He gets prosecuted, and then he spends more than 20 years in jail before he's born again. Do I have that right?
Well, I would say he spends more than 20 years in federal prison, and he really, by the time he got to federal prison, he's born again.
Okay.
I mean, he transformed himself in prison and worked on himself. So,
and one of the things I found interesting is you talked about interviewing him at Central Prison, which may have been the first time he was in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, he was trying to convince you that he was innocent, right?
Right. That was, that was after the state trial where Shirley Fulton, probably many of your listeners know that name. She was a fairly young prosecutor at the time who had convicted him. But he had this gun battle with a guy known as Big Lou. And out of the two of them, Big Lou was really the heavy. He had a long record. And after Belton was convicted, I went to Central Prison. He agreed to an interview, and, you know, I was a young reporter. I was 26, and I had this idea that I would write this kind of New Yorker, New Yorker kind of
right.
portrait of a shootout, and he was going to tell me the inside story of this, their spat. And he did not. He told me he was innocent. He was, you know, had a business cleaning, fast food restaurants, which he had before he started dealing, and really told me not much of value. The only memorable line was his description of Big Lou, his nemesis. He described him as a dinosaur, you know, big old body, little old brain. But he was very, despite the fact that I got almost no useful information, he was a very nice guy. And
I like to think that, I mean, the way you've described him in this first section you've read, and you're going to read several more on the show here, but he was a complex individual who was sort of the polite criminal, right?
I mean,
everybody liked him.
Yeah.
he was somewhat philanthropic.
Right.
he would give away some of the money that he earned to people.
Yeah, which is, and I have to say, is not that unusual in with drug dealers in poor communities. I have read and found, and he did it. You know, I mean, it's good business for one thing. You know, giving back to the community, but he also, I do think, genuinely wanted to help people.
So you didn't believe him then, but later. You go back after you decided to write this book and you start to interview him after he's out and he's born again. Did you believe that he did have this conversion? I mean, is he truly a new man now?
He is. And I don't want to sound like I just believed him hook, line, and sinker. You know, when we sat down and from our first interview in 2012, he came to the Observer, and I have told him this since then. You know, he was surprised when I told him this line. I said, but you know, when you're a journalist, you know, the saying is, if your mother tells you she loves you, check it out. So I checked out everything he told me. I talked to everybody I could find who could corroborate what he told me. And I really have never, I mean, since that 2012 interview forward, I mean, I've never, like, caught him in any kind of lie. There were times where his view of a situation was maybe different than another person's view, which you would expect, like in terms of his relationship with his ex-wife, for instance. I have come to find him very reliable.
All right, we're going to talk more about that as we get through, but I wanted to focus on one thing that you covered in this book. You mentioned Shirley Fulton. She was initially the African-American prosecutor in state court of Belton Platte, later became a Superior Court judge. I've actually appeared in front of her. I'm a lawyer, and so found her to be a very competent judge. But one of the things that struck me in the book, you've got a chapter in here. It's called Sentencing a Generation. And you talk about how, though she was doing her job, one day she was down and someone asked her why, and she said, you know, I feel like I've put an entire generation of black men in prison.
Yeah.
So talk about that piece of your investigative research here and her feelings about, because they were guilty of the crimes with which they were charged, and yet... This is also during the time period when they were dealing with the war on drugs. You
yes.
talk about that. And,
right.
And you talk about how she and others put in place this drug treatment courtroom. And it dealt with trying to get treatment for people as opposed to putting them in prison when they possessed drugs. I mean, that's a topic that's still going on today.
Yeah.
Right. And yet the legislature would not want to continue to fund it.
Right. That was a constant fight. So... I found Shirley's memories of this period of her life incredibly powerful. She became the senior resident judge. She started in it, and it was, as you said, it was when crime was a lot higher than it is now, violent crime, and the courts were just stuffed. And she created this administrative court to help streamline things, and it did. And it was a court that had held motions and pleas and first appearances, and it was a grueling job for a judge. In fact, none of the judges wanted to do it, and so Shirley did it for several years, which meant day in and day out, she would see a courtroom of often mostly black men in the morning and then again in the afternoon. And I think it really was kind of soul destroying for her. And she didn't start the drug treatment court, but she was very much instrumental in trying to keep it funded. And that was very discouraging for her because she saw it working. And, you know, this is that drug treatment court and the problems funding it is kind of like a little microcosm, I think, of kind of the whole war on drugs and the problem in this country. We, and still with the opioid epidemic, we don't have the kind of accessible treatment that we need. We really, I think, spend much too much money on prosecuting versus prosecuting and arresting dealers rather than treatment. I think there's a lot of experts that have come to that conclusion.
I do think recently there's been some bipartisan efforts. I actually read led by the Republicans in Congress. Didn't get much play. That's some recent legislation that deals with this opioid epidemic. But to the point, at the time, you have this courtroom filled with black defendants. Mm-hmm. And we know that not just blacks were using drugs.
Right.
Right. And so that's the war on drugs, as you describe in your book, felt like the war on blacks.
Right.
And that was a feeling that she took with her. Okay, so let's get a little more insight into Belton Platt, the youngster.
Yeah, the name of this chapter is Candy Kingpin. In the early 1970s, in the hall outside his Myers Park Elementary classroom, 10-year-old Belton handed out candy and collected coins, a blow pop for a dime, now and laters for a quarter. On good days, he sold out by the time the morning bell rang. He purchased his stock, 5 taffy packs at 10 cents each, 10 bubblegum-filled blow pops for a nickel each, from a rundown grocery near his Dalton Village apartment. He paid with the dollar he received from his parents, who didn't know he got a free school lunch. Then he stowed the candy in his bedroom until it was time to board the school bus for the 5-mile ride to Myers Park. For every dollar outlay, Belton earned $2.25. At day's end, his pants pockets jingled. Among his classmates, Belton stood out for his candy business and also because he was a black boy from the projects at an affluent, formerly all-white school. His presence at Myers Park Elementary was a quirk of history, the product of Charlotte's imperfect attempt to rectify centuries of racial discrimination. The legal challenge that prompted it had come in 1965, when a brilliant African-American civil rights attorney named Julius Chambers filed a lawsuit, Swan v. Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Education, on behalf of 10 black families. Chambers had arrived in Charlotte in 1964 to find a city with blacks on one side of the track and whites on the other, blacks realizing they were not able to be employed as clerks or tellers in banks, so they didn't apply. People sort of accepted that situation in 1964. Schools, too, remain largely segregated, with nearly 90% of black students attending all-black schools in the mid-1960s. This was despite the U.S. Supreme Court's 1954 Brown v. Board of Education ruling that separate but equal schools were inherently unequal, and despite the fact that Charlotte schools no longer had a formal segregation policy. Schools were segregated because neighborhoods were. Swan changed everything. Chambers' central argument was that the Supreme Court in Brown had called for governments to do more than simply forbid segregation. Charlotte's black and white neighborhoods hadn't formed by chance. Discriminatory governmental policies, redlining, zoning ordinances, urban renewal, had created them, so the government was obligated to employ new policies to end the segregation it had caused. In 1969, the white federal judge hearing the lawsuit agreed. James McMillan ordered the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board to mix black and white students in all public schools. Buses, for many years, were used to operate segregated schools, he wrote. There is no reason except emotion, and I confess to having felt my own share of emotion on this subject in all the years before I studied the facts, why school buses cannot be used by the board to provide the flexibility and economy necessary to desegregate the schools. For Belton's candy business, busing meant booming sales. He never questioned why he was being bused to a neighborhood full of white people, but he knew he could count on a cadre of regular customers with ready pocket change, classmates such as Adam Gilbert, an affable kid with black framed glasses and a fondness for now and laters. Adam became Belton's first white friend. Belton loved afternoons at Adam's house, an oak-shaded two-story Tudor across the street from the school. There, he played in a backyard fort on an expansive lawn and ate brand-name snacks in a well-stocked kitchen overseen by hired help, two black women wearing uniforms of black dresses with white aprons. Belton learned that Adam's dad owned several dozen auto parts stores and that the Gilbert family traced its ancestry to Sir Walter Raleigh, the English explorer for whom the capital of North Carolina was named. After school, Belton helped himself to cookies and milk and settled with Adam in a pine-paneled den to watch cartoons on a big color television. When dinner time approached, Adam's mother drove Belton home in her station wagon. It never occurred to Belton to envy the Gilbert family's wealth. Myers Park was another world, and he was just visiting. "I probably compared myself more to my peers in the projects," he said. I was more focused on how blessed we were in the projects compared to others. In our own little world, we were like the rich people. We had a nice apartment with new furniture, and when we needed stuff, we got it. We were one of the top families in Dalton Village.
So Belton Platt, he's a businessman at age 10.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Entrepreneur.
And you can see that the same techniques he used to get his white friends to buy candy at a markup, you know, is what he employed years later when he was selling cocaine.
Yep.
Now, in this little reading that you offer to us, you really hone in on this segregation piece and a couple lines that sort of, I think you explore them later in the book, things like redlining, zoning ordinances, urban renewal. You dig down deeper into that. But just so we have a perspective here, you know, when people talk about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and what have you, redlining was a process, I think, where loans would only be made to certain people that lived in certain areas, right?
So during the Depression, you know, the real estate market, loans just froze, a lot
right.
like they did in 2008 when we had the meltdown. And so to get banks to make loans, the federal government drew up these maps showing different parts of cities and where the safest
the lines
right. And so there was blue, yellow, green, and red. And red was where you didn't want to make loans. That was not good. And those were always all the black neighborhoods, which means you couldn't get any investment
right.
in those neighborhoods. And then
that generation didn't build the equity in homes that
right.
the baby boomers
and
did.
They also couldn't get FHA insured loans. The federal government had a listing of who was the best risk and who was the worst, and I think blacks and Mexicans were down at the bottom, and you know, like people from Scandinavia and England and the United Kingdom were like the best risk. So yeah, you don't buy a house, you don't develop equity, and you know, that's one reason today when you look at the median, when you look at the wealth of blacks versus whites, there's this huge gap of like why the average white family has like, I don't know, 10 or 13 times the wealth
right.
of the average
and
black
so,
family.
So it was hard enough then to get the loan, to get the house, to build the equity, but then when they did, along comes urban renewal. Let's tear down these communities and these wards in downtown. Oh, I guess, am I saying it right? Should be uptown? Sure, whatever.
We
know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Tearing them down to make way for big, pretty, tall, you know, buildings and things of that nature. So it's sort of like they were behind the eight ball in trying to come out, which kind of, you know, you've seen recently there was a study that came out that ranked Charlotte 50th among the top 50 cities in America for the chance of upward mobility. If you were in poverty.
Right.
And do you think that has something to do with this history that you deal with in the book?
Oh, definitely.
But yeah. we're a shiny big city. We're the second largest banking center, and we have all this industry. How could that possibly be?
Yeah. Well, you know, I started the book in Piedmont Courts, which I think I said was, you know, an all-black public housing. And the book ends in Southside Homes, which is, and it ends in the present day. That's where Belton's mom lives now. And if you go and visit Southside Homes, you will find that, you know, it hasn't changed much since it was opened as a black public housing in the 50s. It's pretty much all black. There is just generational poverty. People who have been in public housing, you know, for several their families for several generations, and a number of them are working, but they don't make enough to get out of public housing. They're lucky to be in, to have the public housing, but you know, they might make 10 or 11 or 12 bucks an hour, and that just doesn't
right.
do it in Charlotte these days.
You also talk in this reading about segregation in the schools, and I found it interesting because I grew up during that time period in Charlotte. We went from Brown versus Board of Education in the 1950s to the Swan decision with Judge McMillan in the early 70s. There was the fight between the school board and Judge McMillan about whether to integrate through busing. But then later, after what you describe in your book as an imperfect attempt, the buses stopped running.
Right.
And what I found irony in is that it was the decision in 1999 by Judge Robert Potter, the same judge who sentenced Belton Platt to the maximum plus sum,
right,
who is the one who entered the ruling to stop the busing.
Right.
Now, you studied a little bit about Judge Potter, and he was an ethical judge, an honest judge. He was a ruling for, but in part, he, that ruling has sent us back to a time in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools before Swan, right? We're segregated school system at the moment, primarily because of the neighborhood schools concept,
mm-hmm,
right? But these are hard conversations to have, right? Because people want their children to go to school close to where they live, and yet people don't, we're not living together, right? The
right.
Blacks and whites, and we're living, and other people of color, they're not living. I mean, we are. I mean, there is some integration, but not on a grand scale, right?
Well, you still have, if you live in a middle-class white neighborhood, depending where you, predominantly white neighborhood, depending on where you live in town, let's say the university area, your neighborhood might be pretty integrated. The university
right.
area is one area of town that's more integrated. But what you find is these pockets of poverty that are, like, still, that are black and Latino, and then the schools that are serving those neighborhoods end up being, pretty much all free and reduced lunch, and schools that are, 100% poverty have a really hard time, and that's what we've recreated when we ended busing.
All right, when we come back, we're going to explore why Pam decided to write this book and get into some of the aftermath and another reading that deals with sort of the fallout from Belton Platt's life in drugs. While we're on a short break, I want to let you in on a little conversation I had with Charles Fiore, Communications Director of the North Carolina Writers Network.
The North Carolina Writers Network sponsors two contests for fiction writers, one for creative nonfiction writers, another for poets, one for African-American writers of prose, our new Jacobs Jones African-American Literary Prize, and a fellowship for emerging writers. And through these annual contests, we give away $4,000 every year.
So this is sort of a way for a writer to sort of test their mettle. They can try out their skills and compete with other writers?
Yeah, because all of our contests are judge blind. Our winners are sometimes writers who've been published many times, and sometimes when a writer wins, it's their first publication. We often say writing is a very solitary endeavor. So we're putting writers together, sometimes in the same room, sometimes virtually, sometimes just through our programming and communication. But we're there to support writers and support one another.
To learn more, you can find a link to the network's website on our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. Now back to the show. Pam, you were a reporter for many years for The Observer, which requires you to go out and sort of get the facts, put them down on a deadline. This project was different in some ways, but perhaps similar. Tell us about the similarities and differences between what you did with this story and what you did as a reporter.
Well, and actually this book started as a series I wrote for The Observer in 2013. It was a six-part series, so that's pretty long for a newspaper story, but it focused more on Belton and his family. The book is much more expanded to talk about Charlotte and its history. But in some ways I feel like this book is a do-over, because especially when you're doing daily journalism, you might have, if you're lucky, a week or two to do a story, big story for the weekend, and you are limited by your time and also by what people will tell you in the moment. And when I look back at the stories I wrote about Belton's trial and the shootout, I feel like they're very incomplete. So this was really satisfying to go back. And for one thing, I found is when you wait 20 or 30 years to talk to somebody about something controversial, they're much more forthright. And so there were a lot of people who talked to me, you know, guys who were former drug dealers who would not have talked to me at the time. So it was really satisfying as a reporter and a writer to get that kind of depth. And what I hope with the book, it's maybe a little closer to the truth. I mean, you know, the truth is a slippery thing. And but you
had kind of a head start in the sense that you'd written these stories, but yet you had to go dig deeper. And how long did you research the story before you wrote it?
I guess I started in 2012, and I was doing a MFA program in narrative nonfiction, and this became my project. And somewhere along the way, my mentors were saying, you know, we think this could be a book. We think you could get this published. So,
and you went, yes.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Well, yeah, that was very encouraging. Right. I had some really great mentors who helped me kind of see the larger story. So, I mean, I guess I worked on it about 6 years in all. And, you know, the thing about writing narrative nonfiction, when you're talking about the present day, is I wasn't sure what the ending was going to be for a long time. And some things happened in Charlotte that shaped the book while I was working mm-hmm. on it. One was that social mobility study you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. Which I think really helped me see that was a theme I should focus on. One was the Keith Lamont Scott right. shooting, which I think was kind of an example of Charlotte's buried history and anger rising up. And you know, there was, I thought I was going to end the book with one of Belton's sons, and that didn't work out. Another son that I didn't think would work out ended up kind of helping me in the book. And so it was very fluid when you're writing about the present day and real people who are still alive.
Yeah. So Pam, one of the things I'm doing in season two here is playing this little game I call First Draft. It's a short exercise to get to know the writer a little bit better. Mm-hmm. You get two choices. You can pick one or the other or neither or both.
Okay.
And you can editorialize. The first question is ink, pen, or keyboard?
Keyboard.
Yeah, you like the keyboard.
I started out with the ink pen, but I can write faster with the keyboard. So I like to do a lot of my interviews when I'm doing face-to-face interviews. I type.
Well, we know what you did here, but maybe you've done something different. Poetry or prose?
I like both.
Yeah.
But I read more prose than poetry.
Fiction or nonfiction?
Both. I love literary fiction.
Mm-hmm. But you write nonfiction.
But yeah. I write nonfiction. Yeah. But and I'll just say, you know, sometimes I think literary fiction can be truer than nonfiction.
Okay, as a writer, morning or night, or neither?
Morning.
Morning?
Yeah.
Outline or free flow?
Free flow. I probably should try to outline more, but
but your research is probably, you're gathering that and
and
you're assembling it. And it's kind of a combination of both, I imagine. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of in my head, but I'm not somebody who sits down and does a formal outline when I write a story.
Writing or editing?
I do like to have that first draft done and go back and start improving it,
Library or Google?
Google, just because it's faster for lots of things, but I do love doing research.
Then you got to go to the library to check whether it's accurate. Right?
Well, I mean, there are some things I had to go to the library for. Like, look, I actually was looking at, I lived near Davidson College and went to their library to look through the microfilm to look up some old stories. I couldn't find any other way. And I had a student come by and say, "What is that?" So I had great fun explaining this microfilm. It's so cool.
How about that? Yeah. What? That's a VCR. What is that? Dictionary or spell check?
Well, both.
Yeah.
I use thesaurus.com a lot.
Introvert or extrovert?
Introvert, but not like way introverted.
Yeah.
Kind of near the middle.
There you go. E-reader or paper book?
Paper.
Yep. Like to hold it. Social media or personal appearances?
I like talking to people in person better.
Would you prefer to be marketing your book or doing manual labor?
Depending on the manual labor, maybe manual labor. Marketing the book is, it's got to be done, but I would much rather be, writing and reporting.
So Money Rock, we didn't talk about the name you do in the book, but that was a nickname he got when he was in the cocaine business. He wore a lot of jewelry, right?
He did. A police officer once said he wore enough jewelry to drown him in a swimming pool.
Okay. And he was, he went from drug dealer to preacher, but then despite his turnaround, and this speaks to another undercurrent of your book, and that is what happens to the children of people who find themselves in prison. I'd like you to read this last piece here from Coming of Age in a World-Class City, in which you deal with some of this fallout.
Right. And I should probably just say, before he went to prison, Belton had 11 kids with 7 different women before he went to federal prison. This impoverished, violent undercity, the shadow side of Charlotte's progress narrative, was where most of Belton's 11 children were growing up. Several, including Latoya and little Lamont, the 2 children he had with Janie, lived in Dalton Village. When nighttime gunfire erupted, Janie hustled them out of their beds and onto the floor or into a closet. Little Lamont recalled witnessing a shooting apparently provoked by the theft of a beer and how the victim's shoes came off as the bullet struck him and he hit the ground. Rhonda's sons, meanwhile, learned about gang life in the Hidden Valley neighborhood, home of the notorious Hidden Valley Kings. Kim, Belton's oldest daughter, was 7 years old when she saw her friend take a stray bullet in the leg. Kim had been beside her, but had moved at the last second. I was blessed because I got up. I would have got shot in the head. A few years later, she watched from her backyard in Dalton Village as men tackled a neighbor accused of being a drug snitch, pulled down his pants, and cut off his penis. Emergency workers attended the man and held up a sheet to block neighbors' view. By then, Kim had seen the whole thing. In junior high, Kim carried a box cutter in her backpack, protection against a Dalton Village boy who threatened to rape her. When a school administrator found it, she was expelled. The principal said they understood, but they had zero tolerance. She spent her 8th grade year in an alternative school. It seems logical to conclude that living amid this kind of violence might damage a child, but it took a major brain science study in the late 90s, several years after Taking Back Our Neighborhoods was published, to explain exactly why. The Adverse Childhood Experiences Study found childhood trauma, an absent or depressed parent, abuse, neglect, exposure to violence, heightens a child's stress levels, creating higher cortisol levels. Without treatment, developing brains can be permanently changed, making a person more likely to erupt in anger and exhibit disruptive behavior, creating lifelong health and social problems. Studies have also shown that children perform substantially worse on tests following a recent homicide near their home. When they experience the shock of local violence, children appear to be less intelligent than they are, sociologist Patrick Sharkey has written. Perhaps the biggest challenge the Taking Back Our Neighborhoods project faced was persuading prosperous Charlotte to care enough to do something. The Observer appealed to readers' self-interest and civic pride, pointing out that taxpayers ended up footing the bill for violence in the form of higher police and hospital costs, and that sagging property values in high crime areas exacerbated the property tax burden in more affluent areas. If we don't address conditions in the inner city, we'll follow Detroit, where jobs are leaving by the carload, or Atlanta, where the city is becoming poorer and more balkanized, Mayor Richard Vinroot told the newspaper. The city's community development director, meanwhile, trotted out a favorite local argument. If we're going to build a world-class city, we can't abandon the underprivileged. Yet, the deep abiding role that racism had played in creating these high-crime, underemployed neighborhoods went largely unmentioned. One of the first stories in the Observer series included several paragraphs on urban renewal, explaining how the city demolished black communities in the 1960s and 70s, how displaced families resettled, and how the chaos hurt property values and destabilized the central city, which had lost 21% of its population since 1970. This was accurate as far as it went, but the summary didn't convey the massive tragedy of urban renewal, how it had destroyed businesses, scattered churches, severed community connections, and concentrated poverty in Charlotte. The Observer also didn't delve into the decades of discriminatory housing and economic policies that helped explain why black citizens were so much more likely than whites to live in Charlotte's poor, crime-ridden neighborhoods. This was a conscious decision, Chandler recalled. We had long discussions about whether to include quotes and explanations about the vestiges of slavery, but everybody worried that calling out racism would shut readers down.
So what do you think about that last piece as a journalist?
I worked for The Observer during that time, and I wasn't involved in that project, but I can totally see that discussion occurring. And you know, I really appreciate that. That was Liz Chandler, who's a former Observer reporter, a really great reporter, and I really appreciated her candor in telling us that. I think if it had been up to Liz, there probably would have been more about slavery and that connection.
So it's hard when you grow up and you're not facing these difficulties. I'm speaking as a white male here, and understanding what other people are going through, for that string to go all the way back to what you just mm-hmm. talked about, slavery. But there is a connection, a thread that runs through these things that people. Why do you think it's so hard to talk about?
That's a good question. I'm glad you asked that. Because we buried this history, and I mean I didn't understand it either. I mean, I knew that when I saw these poor black neighborhoods, I knew that discrimination and segregation and all those things played a part, but I didn't know enough details of what actually happened to kind of draw that line. And, you know, this is, I think, being pointed out more and more, and this is one reason I wanted to write the book. I wanted to help people understand our history and how we got here.
And you mentioned something here. You see something on the news, you know, a child took a box cutter to school, and you think, what lawlessness is going on here that children would do something mm-hmm. like that? And you don't think about what you just wrote about here, that particular student is in fear of being raped, and mm-hmm. they have it in their backpack for protection. And but then on the other side, you know, we've had shootings in the school here, and we've got to keep the guns and the weapons out of the school system. So
we do, but I just think a zero tolerance approach is like a blunt instrument, and I've heard a number of judges in our system mm-hmm. say that as well. Juvenile court judges like Lou Trosh will tell you that that was not a good thing.
Now you've done an excellent job here of telling a story about a central character and his family, and also telling a story of Charlotte. But through that process, you've also done some exposing of the underbelly, so to speak. And my question now is to you, maybe it's not fair, but you've done all this research, so I'll throw it at you anyway. What are your thoughts on some of the things that can be done to improve conditions for those who live in poverty and those who are, you know, dealing with this vestige that's hanging over their heads?
I think that probably a lot of the solutions are outlined in the Economic Opportunity Report that our community did, and that's not the exact title, but you know what I'm talking mm-hmm. about. And it's everything from a lot more affordable housing to, kindergarten or preschool for everyone. I think that, what I just read there about the trauma that so many kids experience in their neighborhoods, I think we need a lot more counselors in schools to work with these kids to counteract the effects of this trauma that can cause really lifelong problems and just kind of keep creating this cycle over and over again. The problem is, I think a lot of these can't be solved at the local level. I don't think Charlotte can ever build enough affordable housing without some federal help, which doesn't seem to be forthcoming. Same with mass incarceration. There needs to be federal reform. So it's kind of all kinds of things. I think our local leaders are on the right track in a lot of ways, but it's small doses versus what's needed.
And you're, we talked about the difficulty talking about race. You're a white journalist. Have you received any pushback as to whether you're, sort of qualified to tell this story in a way? Have you thought about that?
I have thought about it. I have a lot. I have not received any pushback. I'm
good.
Kind of surprised.
Yeah.
What I would say is I am certainly aware that as a white journalist, I haven't had this, and as growing up middle class in Ohio, I didn't live through this, but my answer would be, it is a story. It was a story that needed to be told, and for the reasons that we've talked about, I think I was in the best position
right.
to tell it.
Because you saw it firsthand as a reporter.
Yeah.
And then you sat down with the person who lived it, and you kind of told the story through, in a lot of ways, from his perspective at times
right.
as well, and that helps.
And from his mother's, who grew up in segregated Charlotte.
Yeah, we didn't talk about this. There's so much in this book we can't talk about in a 45 to 50 minute mm-hmm. podcast. You did talk about the mother who was discouraged as well. She was an activist. She tried to do her best raising her children, and yet she had a son who turned out this way. You talked about Harvey Gantt, the African-American mayor of Charlotte, who was one of the persons that after that 1983 shooting, let's crack down, let's do this, and yet he started rethinking some things as well, I believe you talked about
mm-hmm.
in your book. But, you've done a good job of not wrapping this up in a nice little bow at the end. It's a conversation starter. yeah. And, if you look at the 2010 census, and I looked at this the other day in light of what we're going to be doing today, this is a changing community. Whites make up 45%, and people of color are now in the majority in this community.
Yeah.
Made up of blacks, Hispanics, Asians, and others. So I think it's a conversation we have to have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've talked about this before we started, but I live in northern Mecklenburg County in Cornelius, and in the Cornelius and Davidson area, I think the county is about a third African American. Cornelius and Davidson are getting whiter and fewer. I think Cornelius right now has about 5% black population. So we're continuing to we're segregating in new ways, actually, which is not good.
Well, that's that'll be a topic for your next book, right?
Yeah.
So tell us, Pam, where can people find your book?
Everywhere. Mm-hmm. Locally, Park Road Books, Main Street Books in Davidson, Barnes & Noble, stores on Amazon.
And do you have a website people can find you?
I do. It's bypamkelly.com, and that's all one word, and it's Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y.
Great. Well, Pam, I want to thank you for coming on the show today, for writing this book, starting the conversation, and for having a conversation with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, that's it for today. Another fine author giving voice to their written words. If you liked our show, we'd very much appreciate your help in spreading the word. You can do that by telling your friends or by leaving a review on iTunes, also known as Apple Podcasts, or by connecting with us on social media. Our social media links are at our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. If you sign up for our email list at our website, you'll get a free ebook, a novel written by your host. And by the way, if you do sign up for our email list, we promise not to spam you, just send you periodic updates about the show. Next week, we'll have another interesting author read and talk about their work. I hope you will join us. Until then, I'm Landis Wade for Charlotte Readers Podcast.